I'm Vivian Jennings from Rainy Day Books, and we're going to just get right to it. It is my real pleasure to welcome back to Kansas City a remarkable woman to talk about a remarkable book. So please help me welcome the former Secretary of State and future grandmother, Hillary Rodham Clinton.
All right.
That was great.
Hello.
Okay, guys. Sit now. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, my gosh. Okay, sit. What did I tell you? Just like your kids. I told you to sit down. I told you to put your cameras and phones away now. Turn them off. Didn't I say how courteous and everything respectable that Kansas City is? There you go. Okay. Behave. First, I want to just say something before we get started. I want to say something to the audience. It's very important to me. Beyond what we are able to talk about this evening, there is a remarkable story in the pages of this book. It's a story of country, love of country, public service, but it's also about a woman who shares a piece of wisdom in this book about living your life. I have loved and been loved. All the rest is background music. So, I know you're going to enjoy the conversation tonight, but the full story is in the book. So let's get started.
Yes.
You've just concluded your presidential campaign. And you're taking no. Stop. You're taking a nice walk in the woods with your husband.
That's right.
And the phone rings, and it's your opponent. And tell us about the opportunity that came after that.
Well, first, let me thank you for hosting this wonderful event. I apologize that we were somewhat delayed, but I've been looking forward to it because we had such a good conversation about my book, Living History. So it's a real treat to be back in Kansas City. I write in the book about a lot of hard choices. And the one that Vivian is talking about happened after the 08 election in November. As I write in the book, I ended my campaign in June of 2008 and went to work on behalf of then-Senator Obama's campaign. And my husband and I together did more than 100 events, and we were so pleased and frankly relieved when he was elected. The Sunday, yes, indeed. The Sunday after that election, we decided to take a long walk, which we love to do to kind of clear our heads. And we were in the middle of this wooded preserve near where we live in New York. There are woods in New York, yes. And Bill's cell phone rang, and he dug it out of his pocket, and it was then President-elect Obama asking if he could talk to us. And Bill said, well, we're in the middle of a forest preserve, but we will get back to you as soon as we get home, which we did. And on the way home, Bill said, I think he's probably calling to ask us about people that he's considering for positions and what we might have to say. And sure enough, when we got home and Bill called him back, that's what he wanted to talk to Bill about. And then he asked to talk to me, and he said, I'd really like you to come see me as soon as you can. And I didn't think too much of it because I assumed that just as we had started talking about the campaign after my primary campaign ended, and I was going back to the Senate in New York, we would be talking about how we would work together on all these important issues because, you know, then President-elect Obama was inheriting two wars and a terrible economic crisis. So he said, well, I want you to come see me as soon as you can. I said, okay. Then I started hearing from some of my friends who said, you know, there are all these rumors that he's going to offer you something, maybe Postmaster General. We don't quite know. And I said, well, you know, I don't think that's likely. And I don't really believe that, but I also don't want to leave the Senate. I'm looking forward to working with him in the Senate. Fast forward, I go to Chicago, which is where the transition headquarters were, and am ushered into this big room where the president-elect is waiting. And he, after how are you, small talk, he basically gets right to the point and says, I want you to be Secretary of State. And I said, Mr. President-elect, I'm flattered, I'm honored, but there are other people who could do this job. And I started giving him names. And he said, no, I've thought a lot about this. I later learned he'd actually talked to some people about it earlier that fall. And he said, I have to spend all my energy on the economy, which is still in perilous straits. And yet we can't not pay attention to the rest of the world, especially at this time of global economic crisis. And you're the person I want. I said, you know, I'm so flattered. I'm so honored. I was kind of like sounding like a broken record. And I said, but I really want to go back to the Senate. It is where my heart is. He said, well, I'm not taking no for an answer. I want you to think about this, and then we can talk again. So, well, that's all I did was think about it. And I was doing one of these on the one side this and the other side that. I was talking for hours to my husband and my daughter and a few other people. I called some of my colleagues in the Senate. But I was having a hard time getting to yes. So I thought, it's not fair to him. He's trying to put his team together. So I called him and I said, you know, President-elect, I am just not able to say yes, but I will do everything I can to support you. He goes, well, that's not good enough. I'm sorry, that's not good enough. I am not ready to take no for an answer. And I'm thinking, really? Now, my husband later said to me, well, you know, I did ask you to marry me three times before you said yes. And I said, yeah, I do remember that, too. I don't know what it is with these charismatic men that I'm acquainted with. So I thought and thought. And meanwhile, his staff was not putting my calls through anymore. Rahm Emanuel, who was going to be chief of staff, said, he's indisposed. You can't talk. Indisposed. I could see he was working, you know, around the clock. I stayed up all night because I knew I had to say one way or the other and convince him. I stayed up all night, and here's what I finally thought. I thought, suppose roles had been reversed, and for whatever reason, I had won and I wanted him to be in my cabinet because I was worried about what the country was facing and all the problems that we had to deal with very quickly. Of course I would want him to say yes, and I have this old-fashioned idea that when your president asks you to do something, you probably should say yes. So early in the morning, after a totally sleepless night, I did reach out, and I said, look, I really need to talk to him this time. And I was still getting the runaround. I said, and I think he'll be glad I called. Oh, okay, fine. So when we talked, and I told him I'd be truly honored to serve, and I would do so. And we began talking about the challenges we were going to face. At the end of the conversation, he said, contrary to reports, I think we can be good friends. And as I write in the book, it wasn't just a professional partnership that we developed, really under very difficult circumstances, trying to make a lot of quick decisions and consequential ones, but it was also a friendship. So I'm glad I finally said yes, and I am grateful that I had this opportunity to serve the president and serve our country.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have the job, and you had a new approach to think broadly about where and how we could use all the elements of American foreign policy in concert. Talk to us about smart power.
Well, I had been in the Senate. I had served on the Armed Services Committee, and of course, as a senator from New York, I was deeply involved in the aftermath of the attacks on 9/11, because so many of my constituents were murdered that day. Their families were bereft. There were grievously injured people. Lower Manhattan was destroyed. So I had been very focused on the need for what we call hard power, because obviously when you are attacked and when you face ongoing threats, which we did because of my position in the Senate, I was quite privy to a lot of the ongoing threats that we were confronting. I knew that, of course, defense has to be front and center in the aftermath of something like that, but it cannot come to dominate how our country deals with the rest of the world. And that I wanted, from the beginning of my time at the State Department, to send a very clear message that we were going to integrate and better utilize all the elements of American power, diplomacy, development through USAID, and, of course, defense. And as I write in the book, I had a very good partner with the Secretary of Defense at the time, Bob Gates, because he, too, had seen what I had perceived, and that is that the rest of the world thought that we were acting in a unilateral way and that the only means for us to try to solve our problems was military. So I sent a message that was meant to be both a principled position but also a communication to the rest of the world that we were going to use what some commentators had dubbed, quote, smart power. And instead of getting into a really unsatisfying debate between hard power, namely the military, and soft power, diplomacy, cultural development, foreign aid, those kinds of elements, that we would be much smarter in how we deployed our resources. And it helped me as I began to reach out to leaders and talk about what we were trying to do and hear from them. And then as I began to travel, that I was coming as a representative of a new administration and, of course, of our country that has many tools in our toolbox, and most importantly, our values, who we are, what we stand for, freedom and democracy and opportunity. All of that is what I think undergirds our strength. And to get our economy moving again, begin to, you know, create jobs, help people recover, those were going to take different approaches. So I used the phrase smart power both to help us better organize within the State Department and at USAID, but also to send a message to the rest of the world that we were not going to be going out and saying to people, you know, our way or the highway. We were going to be listening, and we were going to try to find, if possible, and it's not always possible, but if possible, some win-win common ground solutions to the issues that we faced.
Great. You write that in the history of foreign policy, there has been a running debate between the so-called realists mm-hmm. and idealists. You actually consider yourself a hybrid, sort of a idealistic realist. So right. What's the distinction?
Well, for me, and it is a long-running debate, and it is deeply rooted in different views of human nature as well as the organization of societies, particularly nation states. And I am a realist when it comes to accepting the fact that people, at the end of the day, are going to act in their own self-interest and how they define it. And particularly nations are living, breathing organisms that have oftentimes millennia of history, sometimes only decades, but they have learned lessons, for better or worse, that they are now going to be applying when they look at their position in the world. That, to me, is absolutely undeniable. However, if your only lens for looking at and dealing with the world is a kind of hyper-realistic one, like, you know, that people will never respond to universal human rights. Women and girls in some parts of the world will always be marginalized and oppressed. Technology is a device, but it's not going to change how people think or interact. I mean, if you basically come down to saying, you know, at the end of the day, this is all about power and how power is held and how power is used and defined in these different settings, then you have a worldview, but I think it's a worldview that does not recognize the power of values and ideas and underestimates the historic power of the United States of America. Because our values and our ideals have driven us to constantly improve our own views about how to make our society more inclusive, how to ensure that we are at least attempting to be as close to those values as possible, recognizing we don't always make it, that we have self-correcting accountability within our political system. So we are selling ourselves short if we do not temper our realism with idealism. So that, for example, when I go around the world as your Secretary of State and I say to leaders, I think that you're missing a lot of what could be effective in your society because of the way you treat women and girls, I'm saying that both because I believe it. It is a core value that I have about human rights and in particular about the full participation of women and girls, but it's also wedded to realism because societies that do not allow for the full participation don't have the economic growth, don't have the peace and security, don't have the development of democracy. So trying to keep those two thoughts in mind at the same time is why, you know, for want of a better phrase, I call myself an idealistic realist, not as a dodge, not to try to cover the bases, but because I think it is to our detriment if we have our head in the clouds and we expect people, just because we are urging them to, behave in a certain way without recognizing the realities of the situation. But I think it's also a loss for us if we just are moving the pieces around on the chessboard and don't recognize how our values helps to reshape that chessboard. So this was an exciting experience for me because it allowed me to put into words and actions what I'd been thinking about ever since I was a college student and got interested in international relations. And thought a lot about how people obtain power and use power. I'll tell you a quick story, and this kind of fits into this hybrid. My first trip was to Asia in February 2009, and I chose that deliberately. Secretaries of State make a statement with their first trip, and for all kinds of reasons, at different times, people would go to Europe to kind of make the rounds of our longtime allies, they might go to the Middle East, they might even go to Canada or Mexico, as some of my predecessors have done. I chose Asia because as I began calling and talking to Asian leaders, they would say, does the United States intend to reassert your presence in the Asia Pacific? Are you going to continue to play an active role? I said, well, of course. And then they would say, well, it has appeared for the last years that you've been so focused on, you know, South Asia, the Middle East, that we've been kind of an afterthought. So I said, okay, I will come that first trip. One of the other goals that I had was to conduct what's called public diplomacy. In other words, don't just define diplomacy by the meetings you have with presidents or kings or prime ministers or foreign ministers, usually behind closed doors in palaces or presidential offices and the like, but practice this public diplomacy. Try to connect with the people of a country, because even in dictatorships, autocracies, authoritarian regimes, leaders today have to pay some attention to what people think in large measure because of technology
and particularly social media. So I was going to appear on a show in Indonesia, which was kind of a cross between MTV and The View. And it was called The Awesome Show. And it was early in the morning, and I was there, and there were these really energetic young people, and they would jump up and down between guests. I mean, they had so much energy. And one of them asked me, how could you work with Barack Obama? You ran a hard campaign against him. And he said terrible things about each other. How can you work with him? And I could understand their amazement. I mean, this is a very new democracy, like maybe 10, 12 years old. And they're trying to understand how it's supposed to work. And, of course, they look to us. And they also have the experience that if you're in an election, even if it's not the most valid election, if you lose, you could be exiled or imprisoned or even killed, not hired as Secretary of State. So there was a lot of curiosity. And I said, you know, the president asked me to serve, and I agreed because we both love our country. And we thought it important to put any personal concerns, any controversies behind us in order to serve the public good. And there was this real sense of digestion going on in the faces of the people. That was one of the most common questions I was asked from that first trip to my last trip. And that gets me back to the kind of realist, idealist difference. I mean, people were struggling to understand, how does democracy really work? What are the values? Another quick example, I was in Burma. One of our goals, and you'll read about it in the book, was to try to come up with a different policy toward Burma, which I had been hearing was perhaps on the brink of beginning to open up. And, of course, I wanted to push that. Aung San Suu Kyi is someone whom I deeply admire, has become a friend. So when I went to Burma, after we'd laid all this groundwork, I went to the new capital called Naypyidaw, and I went to the parliament building, and I visited the lower house and the upper house. And in the big lower house, the speaker of the lower house proudly announced that they were looking to America to learn how to run a parliament. And I felt really good about that. Yeah, I know. But, you know, these things come and go. And you know, at base, we are the longest surviving democracy. So I was pretty proud. And I said, well, how have you been doing that? And he just stood up totally straight and he said, we have been watching the West Wing. So, you know, you have to be aware, and I certainly became even more aware, how people around the world watch our every move, every word of our leaders. Right. And sometimes, although obviously our primary concern is our own country and how we're, you know, going to do what we need to do, and we have our back and forth, our partisanship and political debate and all of that, but it is important to know that people are watching. And part of the reason they're watching is they want to know how to do it. Right. And I find that an exhilarating possibility, but also a heavy responsibility.
Well, and you're right. In today's hyper-connected world, our ability to communicate with publics as well as governments has to be part of our national security strategy. So that's what you're talking about. And you went out and out and out. I mean, one time you were sent, and your staff said to you, you're going to be a punching bag, and you said, punch away.
Right, right.
So, but you've had town hall meetings in some of the most hostile countries
right.
on the planet. What was that like?
Well, it was challenging, to say the least, but I thought it was necessary. And a couple of quick examples. One that you referred to, the punching bag. I was going to Pakistan for the first time, and as First Lady and as Senator, I had been to Pakistan. I went as First Lady when Benazir Bhutto was Prime Minister and struck up a friendship with her, which lasted until she was murdered. Got to know her children, got to know her husband. And I went as Senator to push the Pakistanis under then former General President Musharraf to be more vigorous in the pursuit of terrorists, which threatened them as well as the Afghans and our troops in Afghanistan. But when I went back as Secretary of State in the fall of 2009, I was fully briefed about the attitudes that many Pakistanis have about the United States. And it was so distressing. The population is often manipulated by other forces within the society who put forth a conspiracy theory at least once a day. We had an excellent ambassador there, a career experienced foreign service officer, and when I spoke with her, she recounted how hard it was to stay ahead of these conspiracy theories. The United States was responsible for everything that did not go right in the eyes of very significant players within Pakistan. You know, my big concern was the terrorist threat because that was directly connected to our national security at home. Some of you remember, you know, the so-called Times Square bomber who had been trained in Pakistan, thankfully prevented from exploding a vehicle in Times Square not so long before. So when I went to Pakistan, I said, I don't want to just talk to the leadership, because I'm pretty sure I could tell you right now what they will say, because I've been there and done that. I want to get out, I want to talk to the press, which has a reputation for being quite hostile to us, and I want to do town halls. So I did, and when I said this to my State Department team, they said, well, you're just going to be a punching bag. And I said, well, I need to show that I respect them enough to be honest with them and see whether there is any way to break through what up until then had been a wall of deniability about what was happening there. Because after all, it's the Pakistanis themselves who have suffered the most from terrorism, more than 30,000 when I was Secretary of State, military and civilian victims, you know, markets bombed. We just saw the attack on the Karachi airport. And I say in the book that this is partly a result of a calculated strategic decision by the military and intelligence services of Pakistan to keep proxy terrorists, to deal with India, to deal with Afghanistan. And it's like you think you can keep poisonous snakes in your backyard and they will only bite your neighbor. And these snakes have come back to bite the Pakistanis in a very big way. So when I got there, I did some round tables with the press and I did a town hall, and you'll see and read about how really vitriolic a lot of the exchanges were. And there was one memorable exchange where a group of journalists were just going at me that, you know, everything the United States... And there, that was particularly galling to me, both because the United States provided more development assistance to try to help the people of Pakistan than everybody else put together, and that we had been pushing the Pakistanis to do more themselves, but the elite very often did not care about educating all the children, did not care about many of the terrible conditions Pakistanis live with. So we were kind of in this back and forth, and finally... You know, I said, I find it hard to believe that no one in this government knows where Al-Qaeda is. And there was a silence. And, you know, a lot of shuffling and carrying on. And I just waited. Nobody had anything to say. The White House was later asked, and one of the White House reporters asked the White House press secretary, do you think it was appropriate for Secretary Clinton to be so blunt? And thankfully they said, absolutely, because we had tried many different approaches, and and it wasn't working. I mean, the Pakistanis had some legitimate concerns going back to the 80s and what we did with them to drive the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan, including arming Mujahideen, one of whom was Osama bin Laden. So the Pakistanis had legitimate concerns, but their approach towards solving the problems that their own country faced were very counterproductive. I talk about some of the other town halls that weren't quite so, you know, so grim. And we can get back to Bin Laden if you choose, Vivian. But, you know, otherwise I would be at a women's college in South Korea, and there'd be thousands of these incredibly bright young women, and they would ask me anything. Like, how do you define love? You know, well, I don't know. Let's try. And I particularly appreciated the town halls with young people because what I had seen from all the research that I analyzed upon becoming Secretary of State is that our world is more than half young, under 35. And in some countries, the population up till 25 is 50% or 60%. And many of those young people did not know very much about the United States. They did not know that the U.S. Defeated fascism in World War II. They did not know that the U.S. had been in the Cold War and ended up seeing the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the defeat of international communism. They did not know that in many parts of the world it was American scientists and researchers and charities and faith groups and others who had consistently tried to help improve lives. They didn't know. So any chance I got to go to an audience of young people, I immediately said yes, so that I could be in some way trying to explain to them our values and how we try to make decisions, but also how we try to empower and help people everywhere.
And you share some stories, a lot of stories in the book about all the people you've met along the way. You've met some great friends, made some great friends. And tell us a little bit about your fellow fashion icon and identical twin in Germany.
Well, I am an unabashed admirer of Chancellor Merkel. I first met her in the 1990s. And had stayed in touch with her off and on. She and I even were on a TV program together once in Germany. And I really, I just really enjoy her. And we, so she knew me quite well when I became Secretary of State, as I did her. So we could quickly get to whatever the bottom line was and then try to resolve what our issues were the best we could. And then have dinner, have something that was more fun. And so the president invited her to come to Washington for a state visit. And I hosted a big lunch at the State Department and invited Vice President Biden. And it was to honor Chancellor Merkel. And we did the toasting and the role of hospitality and diplomacy, of graciousness. Everywhere you go in the world, they want to feed you because that's the oldest form of connecting with people and sitting down, having a meal. So I believed that was important too. So we're at the lunch and I get up and we, you know, exchange toasts, and then it's Chancellor Merkel's time. And she has something covered with a cloth. And she said she'd brought this gift for me, and she takes the cloth off. And it was the front page of one of the biggest German newspapers. And we were standing side by side for my last visit to Berlin, and she and I had done a press conference. And the newspaper had cut our heads off because we were identically dressed. I had on a long jacket. She had on a long jacket. I had on black pants. She had on black pants. And the headline was, "Who is the chancellor and who is the secretary?" So she presented that to me, and we just, you know, I just thought it was incredibly funny and very touching, and I have kept it with me ever since. It's a good reminder of a friendship with someone who has done an extraordinary job for her country.
And then there was an incredible change of leadership in Liberia. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, what a difference from Charles Taylor.
Right. Right.
To meet her.
Well, I also had known Ellen for a number of years, in part because as a senator and first lady, I was following the terrible civil war in Liberia, our U.S. embassy in Monrovia for a period of months became the only safe haven in the entire city, and people were desperately seeking refuge there. So when she was elected president the first time, we were all just extraordinarily gratified that someone of her integrity and her commitment would be elected president. There was, for any of you who are interested, there is an extraordinary documentary that really shows the path to Ellen's victory by demonstrating what it took to end the Civil War. What it took was the women of Liberia coming together and basically saying, enough, you must stop. Now, that sounds pretty simplistic, but that's what happened. Muslim women and Christian women joined together. They began sitting out in front of a big fish market in the capital. Their numbers kept ballooning. They began to put a face on the horrors of that civil war, talking about what had happened to their husbands, their sons, their daughters, themselves, because even Ellen was picked up at gunpoint, thrown into a cell, fearing for her life until she was released, and then being exiled, as she was several times. So this documentary shows how the women kept saying, we must have peace, we demand peace. And finally, the warlords agreed to a peace conference, but not in Liberia, in neighboring Ghana, in the capital, Accra. And the women were worried that they'd all go, they'd stay at a nice hotel, they'd eat and drink, and nothing would happen. So a large group of them got themselves to the hotel where the peace conference was happening. They blocked the doors, they blocked the windows, and they said, you will not come out until you have made peace. And so this documentary is called Pray the Devil Back to Hell. Ah. And it is because it also depicted the roles that the church and the mosque played, where these women just would flood in and they would pray and they would sing and they would demand peace. So Ellen was, I went to see her as soon as I could as Secretary of State, and in her very businesslike way, she said, well, you know, we're going to be paying down our debts, we're going to be trying to restore agriculture. There was not a living, there was not a live cow or other livestock left at the end of the Civil War. The country was just devastated. And she had a huge amount to do. So when I came, we met and talked about what we could do to help her. And then she asked me if I would speak at their parliament. She said, because I've got to keep the parliament on board with all my changes. And as we were talking about the speech and my going over to do that, she said, I have a lot of former warlords or their first lieutenants in the parliament. So just be prepared, because you'll be speaking in front of an audience that includes people who had a very bad record in the Civil War. So what she wanted me to do was to sort of explain what Liberia needed to do, applaud the progress that had been made, enlist their support, all of which I tried to do. It was a great ceremony. You all are familiar with the State of the Union when the doors fly open, you know, Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States. Well, the way they did it in the parliament in Liberia was, you know, beating drums and calling through big conch shells and other instruments. And it was very moving to me, because here they were in this parliament trying to find a way forward. So when Ellen ran for re-election, and it was by no means a sure thing, the women of Liberia once again came out to support her and to support her priorities. I went to her inauguration, and you know, they have a long way to go, but the stability that has been brought to their country, the role that women made in enforcing, first getting and then enforcing a peace agreement, gave me a lot of hope that if they could just keep moving forward, and with good leaders hopefully following Ellen when her term ends, because she's term limited, they can try to make up lost ground from the horrors of their civil war.
I love the story about the women, because there's another woman from Northern Ireland that you quote in the book where she says, it takes a woman to bring men to their senses sometimes.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Well, you know, the only thing I would add on this is, of course, I promoted women and girls as an integrated priority within our diplomacy. But I could tell that people's eyes would roll in many places when I said that. So I made a big push to marshal additional evidence on the economy, on social indicators, educating women, you have educated children, on and on. But one area that I was somewhat surprised to learn more about was in this area of peace and security. The role that women must play in bringing about peace and in maintaining it is very clear to me in light of the fact that most peace treaties don't last. They are usually in some way the result of a negotiation with the fighters on both sides, whether they be government fighters or two bands of insurgents coming together. And what we have seen too often is that an insurgent has a hard time making peace, but even if he makes peace, he has a hard time knowing how to keep peace. There's a great story about some warring elements in Darfur trying to resolve boundaries and all kinds of problems, and they were hung up on fighting over who got which side of the river and who had access to the river. And there was a woman, not part of the formal negotiations, who was in and out of the room, and she finally just stopped and she said, I know that river, it has dried up. Oh. So it no longer became such a prize and they could move on to other things. But in many of the areas that I've been directly involved in, and Northern Ireland was one of them, because I worked extensively with the women of Northern Ireland, women must be viewed as peacekeepers. And one of the exciting developments coming out of my secretaryship is the first in the world center on women, peace, and security. It's at Georgetown University. My partner, Milan Verveer, who I write about, who was the first ever ambassador for global women's issues, is now heading it up at Georgetown, and people are starting to pay attention. So sometimes it just takes a lot of persistence and brave women like Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and others who will exemplify what it means to be an active player in bringing about and keeping peace, and there's nothing more important than that.
You say in the book, standing up for women is not just the right thing to do, it is smart and strategic. And the Prime Minister of Japan advanced a term that fits your worldview. Explain womenomics.
Yes. Well, this was a particularly important issue for me because, again, I'd intuitively known this. I remember when I was in Africa as First Lady, and everywhere I drove in sub-Saharan Africa, I saw women in the fields, women with babies on their backs, women carrying water, women carrying firewood, women in the markets. And I was meeting with some economists, and I said to them, how do you evaluate the value of women's work to the formal economy? And they said, we don't. We don't count the informal sector. I said, well, if you don't count the informal sector, how do you in any way make an argument to the leaders of these countries about why women should be able to inherit the land that they till when their husbands die, should be able to get access to credit to start or expand a small business? And basically, their answer was, we just don't do that. We don't have measurements for that. And that was in the 90s. Fast forward. Because of very important work done by a number of organizations, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the UN, private analysts in our country and elsewhere. A picture began to emerge about what it means for every society that women are unable to fully participate in their country's economy. And this is true for everyone. If there are both legal or regulatory barriers that prevent women from holding jobs or having credit or getting the education they need to be employed, or if there are internal cultural prohibitions, so the laws look fine, but in fact nothing ever changes, economies are less effective, they don't grow as much, and their gross domestic product, the GDP it's called, isn't as big as it could be. So when I started getting this information and seeing the pattern that was developing from different sources, I got very excited because I'd made the moral argument, I'd made the human rights argument. I had been, ever since my speech in Beijing in 1995, driving the point that human rights are women's rights and women's rights are human rights, and we had made progress, but we were stalled. And I made a big speech pulling together all of this information in preparation for something called the Asian Pacific Economic Community. And the work had gotten so sophisticated that individual countries could calculate how much money they were leaving on the table in their economy because they had these obstacles to women. There are 100 countries in the world that close hundreds of jobs to women, and many others who have these ceilings that women can't get through. So when the new Prime Minister of Japan came into office, Prime Minister Abe, he came into office on a promise that he would revitalize the Japanese economy, and it had been stagnant in what was called deflation, a huge debt, trying to figure out a way to stimulate it, but it was not moving. And so he started making speeches, and he talked about knocking down trade barriers, and he talked about different accounting and what the central bank would do. But then the catchiest part of his remarks were, we have to encourage more of our educated women to enter the workforce, because there were a large segment of the population who were educated but who were unable, because of the way the Japanese economy and Japanese society was structured, to contribute to the economy. And then Prime Minister Abe said if women economics were to be followed, the gross domestic product of Japan would go up, I think it was 9%. Well, that caught people's attention. And he began writing op-eds. I think one was in the Wall Street Journal. I communicated with him on this because, of course, I was pleased that he was making an economic argument. But you can go around the world. Now, in places where women have been held back, where the economies are often corrupt, crony-heavy, where education hasn't kept up on, like Egypt, if women were able to participate, the gross domestic product of Egypt would increase 34%. So we're talking about real money, as they say, and yet this is true even in developed countries, in the West, Europe, the United States, Canada. We have certainly knocked down a great many, if not nearly all, of the external barriers. I remember when I was in college and law school, when I was growing up even younger, there were just blatant barriers. There were lots of jobs, lots of positions, lots of opportunities that women just were not welcomed to. We've knocked down a lot of that, but as my friend Sheryl Sandberg writes in her book, Lean In, we still are coping with trying to break through a lot of the internal, cultural, almost psychological barriers that girls and women still face. But it's nowhere on the scale as it is with countries in Asia or developing countries. So I was very excited when he coined that phrase and when he began to advocate for more inclusion for women in the Japanese economy.
You You write that you've always been working to strike the right balance, though, between seeing women as victims of discrimination and seeing women as agents of change, which you have just described. So you created an agent of change when you created the first ambassador at large for global women's issues. So talk just a little bit about that, because it's a permanent position now. And
yes. One of the last things that the president did, I think it was my second to the last day as Secretary of State, and I had lunch with him in the Oval Office, was to sign an executive order making permanent the ambassador at large for global women's issues. And it was a very significant commitment by the United States government. And I believe sent exactly the right signal to everyone that these global women's issues were important to our country. And not just because we believe in equality of opportunity and we've been struggling to have a more perfect union and bringing in women and girls and other groups of Americans, but also because it's smart. To go back to my smart power, if you look at the problems we have in the world today, many of them are correlated with situations where girls and women are marginalized, dehumanized, oppressed, relegated to second-class citizenship. So my argument has been that we need to stand firmly on the side of women's rights, not only for the women themselves, and not only for what it can do for their countries, like the economic example I just gave, but also what it means for us. Because when you're a Secretary of State now in the 21st century, there are so many forces and factors at play. And it's important that we be on the right side of human rights for everyone, albeit we often have difficult balancing challenges between our values, our interests, and our security. That was a constant juggle for me. But the Global Women's Office and our ambassador at large is an institutionalized response. I'll tell you a quick story. I went to 112 countries, and some of the countries people said, well, why are you going there? And there was always a reason, and maybe it didn't have any headline attached to it, but it might have had what I call the trend line, you know, that you deal with the crises that are on the front pages, but you always have to keep in mind what's happening in the trend lines in order to try to stay ahead of those. And the whole issue of violence against women is one that has serious effects also on gross domestic product. There was just an event at the World Bank that I participated in where data analysis has shown that countries that tolerate violence against women are also countries that are not developing the way they should economically. Fascinating finding. So when I went to Papua New Guinea, in part it was to work with the government to try to help them be better prepared to deal with some very large energy finds off their coast. This is an issue of great concern to me because so many countries, we can just go around the world and call them out, they find gas or oil and they fall subject to what's called the resource curse. The money historically goes to the rich and the well-connected and the elite and not into schools, not into roads, not into clean water, not into any of the basics that developing countries really need. So in Papua New Guinea, that was the principal reason why I was there. But there was a secondary reason, which at the time I went, it had one of the five highest rates of violence against women of any country in the world. And in some charts, it was number one. So in meeting with the then prime minister, we go through energy and the economy and development. And then I say, but you know, one of the issues that we believe is holding back your country from being as forward-moving as I hear you wish to be is violence against women. And we would be very happy to work with Australia and others to help you write better laws, learn how to implement them, train judges, police, etc. He's looking at me like I have three heads. When I finish, he says, "You know, when a man comes home to work and his dinner is not ready, or it is not to his liking, he must make his displeasure known. And so, I mean, it is not that important. Please do not worry about it." You know, this is where my diplomatic training comes in handy. So, you know, I'm saying, well, Prime Minister, we don't believe that that is, you know, an appropriate, acceptable way to behave. And when someone hits someone else, particularly a man hits a woman or a child, we don't think that's cultural. We think it's criminal. I was not getting anywhere. So we go to the press conference, and I make my statement, he makes his statement, and then one of the American reporters said, "Prime Minister, we hear you have a terrible problem of domestic violence." And in public, he repeats what he had just said to me. And people were astonished. And I met with all of these women, and they said, see what we have to deal with? And, of course, then our ambassador at large for global women's issues, we began working with them, as did the Australians and others. So we worked with civil society. And fast forward, this man was voted out of office. A new prime minister came in. And one of the first things he did was to apologize to the women of Papua New Guinea. So, yay. Now, I would be the first to tell you that that is progress, but boy, there's a long way to go.
Yeah.
Cultural habits, religious beliefs, different forms of discrimination are a continuing problem. But getting it out in public, beginning to make it unacceptable, injecting it into the political debate at least gives us a place to start.
You had two very important mentors in your life dedicated to advocacy of human rights, especially for women and children, Marian Wright Edelman and Eleanor Roosevelt.
Right.
Say what you'd like about those two fabulous ladies.
Well, I never had the great honor of knowing Eleanor Roosevelt, but when I was First Lady, I don't think there was any place I ever went in our country or around the world that I was not greeted by someone saying, "Welcome. Eleanor Roosevelt was here in 1938, 1942, 1956. She was just extraordinary. And her life of service, not only in being a partner with her husband during the Great Depression and trying to be his eyes, ears, and legs because he could not easily move, and then during World War II, sending off her sons to be soldiers in the United States military. And then after his death, one of her most lasting accomplishments was being on the drafting committee for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was agreed to by the countries of the world after the Second World War at the very new United Nations. And it's a remarkable document. She also understood how hard it was to be a woman in public life. And two of my favorite sayings that I have borrowed from her. First of all, if you are a woman and you wish to be in the public arena, you should grow skin as thick as the hide of a rhinoceros. And secondly, a woman is like a tea bag. You've heard this. A woman is like a tea bag. You never know how strong she is until she's in hot water.
I love that. Yeah.
So I deeply admire her. And as Vivian said, when I was in law school, I was at Yale Law School, and I was a freshman, And I saw on the bulletin board, there used to be things like bulletin boards for young people. They may not have ever experienced a bulletin board. But there was a notice up there that Marion Wright Edelman, a Yale Law School graduate, first African-American woman to pass the Mississippi bar, working for the NAACP, was coming to Yale to give a lecture. So I immediately went over and heard her speak and was so impressed. So I go up to her afterwards, and I said, I'm a first-year law student. Could I work for you this summer? And she said, well, you could, but I have no money to pay you. And I said, well, if I could figure out how to get paid, could I work for you? And she goes, well, that's an offer I'm not going to turn down. And I was able to get a paid internship from the Law Student Civil Rights Research Council and go to work for Marion, working on poverty issues and children's issues. I worked particularly that summer on conditions facing migrant farm workers and particularly migrant children. A concern of mine ever since I was growing up in Chicago, because again, it may seem unreal, but back when I was growing up in Chicago, we had still huge farm fields all around the suburb where I grew up, not very far out of the city, and they used migrant workers who were on the path from Mexico up through Texas into the Midwest, and when they finished in Chicago, they would go to Michigan. And our church had a program to support the migrant families, and I was a babysitter for the migrant children on Saturday morning while their parents went out into the fields. And at that time, if there were older children who were in school, they also were in the fields, and so the babies and the toddlers would be left behind, and they needed watching. So I had a particular interest in migrant farm workers. And so I worked that first summer for Marion, stayed in touch with her. When I got out of law school, I went to work for what she had then created, the Children's Defense Fund. And I learned so much working for her. She was absolutely committed to evidence and data as a means for making a case for change. And that first year that I worked for her, the Children's Defense Fund and other organizations were trying to get the data that would explain why all over our country there was a gap. If you looked at census data for school-age children, and then you compared it with school data for public and private schools, there was a gap. So where were these children? And we set up to go door to door in representative census districts, which I did in a place called New Bedford, Massachusetts, knocking on doors, asking if they had school-age children who weren't in school. And we found kids who had dropped out because they had to work, or kids who had to stay home while their parents worked to take care of younger kids. But what we really found were kids with disabilities, because this was before the American government adopted what is still today, I think, the best legislation in the world, that all children, even with disabilities, have a right to go to school to get an education. Yes. And we combined all our data, and those were the days of, handwritten charts and adding machines, and we presented all this data to the Congress, and it was my first experience in seeing how you had to know what you were talking about. You had to have information. And I still think that's the best way for people to make decisions, which is why I also bemoan in the book what I call evidence-free decision-making, which we have too much of today, and we need to get back to actually looking at what the evidence tells us.
Yes. Is there a question you'd really like to talk about that nobody has asked you yet?
Well, there are a couple of themes that people haven't asked me about that are in the book. One is in the chapter I write called Disaster and Development. I talk about how really generous and effective the United States is in dealing with disasters.
Yes.
When there is a tsunami, a hurricane, an earthquake, we can mobilize people and equipment and materials better and faster than anybody. And it could not happen unless the American people themselves both supported what our government does, but more than that, are generous in contributing to charities that are helping people in these terrible natural disasters. Sometimes it's related to conflict. There's a drought because people have cut down all the trees because they couldn't keep warm, and on and on and on. There's erosion, et cetera. So I contrast that, though, with the more challenging issue of development, because as good as we are at disaster relief and response, we are still struggling to bring development into the 21st century. And we have to think differently because, again, the United States is looked to, and we have this remarkable array of partners. You know, when I left the State Department, I joined my husband and my daughter at the Clinton Foundation, and part of what my husband did coming out of the White House was to create a foundation that now has more than 2,000 employees around the world to help solve problems by leveraging what other groups and governments and individuals, businesses, all can do together. And it's that sense of how we try to structure being effective. So, quick example. I fully supported, when I came in, giving food aid in famines and in natural disasters. But what I hadn't fully appreciated is how our giving of emergency food had swamped our efforts to help people grow their own food and be more productive and self-sufficient going forward. So we began to work at the State Department on a program which we called Feed the Future. And it was designed to be more targeted in looking at who these farmers were in Africa and Asia in particular. They were, surprisingly, more than 60% women on these very small plots of land, who often did not have access to drought-resistant seeds, did not understand even simple drip irrigation or other irrigation means, did not have access to credit, did not have legal title to the land, lots of issues. So in our Feed the Future program in our government, we began to work with governments and work with other partners to put a lot more attention on how we could build up local farmers, how they could increase their yield so they not only could feed themselves and their extended families, but have something to feed into a market, broader distribution. That meant we had to start looking at what happened at harvest, because in India, for example, we knew 40% of the harvest was lost because there were no adequate storage facilities. There were certainly no refrigerated storage in most places in the country. So how did we begin to do more to help people take care of themselves, in effect try to work ourselves out of a job down the road? And we did that with healthcare. We did that with other forms of infrastructure and job development. I mean, one of the big differences between the United States and other major players in developing countries is that we often focus on a lot of the human needs, so that our program to supply HIV/AIDS, which my husband worked with President George W. Bush to get the cost of drugs down, we're doing things that don't build buildings. They don't leave soccer stadiums behind. They don't build parliaments that everybody can point to and say, oh, so-and-so built that, or oh, that country built this. So we had to do a better job telling our own story because, as I said many times, the American taxpayers are going to support development, then we need to be as efficient, get the best results, and be given credit for it so that people know that this money is coming from Kansas City or from somewhere else. So I think this whole area of disaster and development, for any of you who might be interested, maybe you work in a nonprofit or you work through your church or faith group, it might be of interest to see what our thinking and what I tried to do was. The second area that is rarely raised in any of my interviews has to do with what we were up against in terms of America's presence and leadership given the economy and what we were struggling with. I think it's absolutely fair to say that many people around the world were very upset with the United States, angry, blamed us for the economic recession that was sweeping the globe. Not fair, but there were elements that people could point to, of course. And there was a growing narrative that the United States was in decline, that our economy would not recover. And part of my job and part of what the president asked me to do was to go out and counter that narrative, make it very clear that we were coming back, that never count America out, that we had the most dynamic, resilient economy. Yes, we had to do some very difficult decision-making, which we did, starting in the Bush administration, continuing in the Obama administration, but that we would get back on our feet. Now, we still have a long way to go. I'm very unsatisfied with where we are at this point compared to where we had been, but we dug ourselves out of the hole, and now we've got to keep climbing. What I tried to do in the State Department was to be a good partner to our economy, to our businesses and our workers, because I knew that other countries put a very heavy thumb on the scale to support their companies. I saw that firsthand when I was a senator, and I write about a very distinguished old American company called Corning, which makes state-of-the-art fiber optics and other advanced equipment. They'd been in China for a long time. All of a sudden, the Chinese government said, we're going to be imposing tariffs, which would have made their business in China uncompetitive, non-profitable. They came to me as a senator. I began trying to help them. I tried to get the Bush administration to help, but they had a different philosophy. Their philosophy was, you know, our government shouldn't be weighing in. We want every government out of the free market. We want, you know, we want governments to be on the sidelines. I said, well, that sounds really good, but that's not the way most of the world does business, and we're going to disadvantage our companies. I got nowhere. And then at my husband's library opening in Little Rock, I invite you all to go sometime. It's a fabulous place. We had all the former presidents, and President George W. Bush was there, and I took him aside, and I said, you know, Mr. President, I explained everything. I said, I really need your help. This is a great company. It's not being treated fairly. And he said, I'll do what I can, and he was as good as his word, and we began to get some response. Well, fast forward, I'm now in the State Department, and yes, we have a Commerce Department, but we're the only government agency that has a presence in every country that we have diplomatic relations with. And therefore, I wanted to do more working with the rest of our government, working with chambers of commerce, working with American business and labor unions to try to present a more united front. And I did that. I mean, I was absolutely traveling the world, making the case for American businesses. And I was doing it both because I was offended by the unfairness that I saw in many different markets, where companies felt like they were shut out or disadvantaged. I mean, there was a contract that, you know, GE had fairly won in Pakistan for locomotives, and a Chinese state-owned company took them to the Pakistani court, stopping the contract from going forward. And there was so much of that, and it was hurting American jobs and American businesses. And so I have a chapter, and it's a chapter about trying to level the playing field. Now, I will say one other point about this. While we were kind of working hard to get ourselves back in the saddle in the economy, we were promoting exports, and we actually did a good job in upping American exports. Lots was happening. But in July of 2011, I was in Hong Kong for a pre-scheduled speech to a big business group, partly to, you know, work on more investments in America, more job creation here at home. And it was right at the time where some in Congress were calling for us to default on our debt. And all of these business leaders from Asia were lining up and asking me, what does this mean? Could the United States throw away the greatest credit in the history of the world? You always pay your debts. And I was saying, oh, don't worry about it. We're going through a little bit of a political battle, but it'll turn out fine. And I, you know, had my hands crossed, my fingers crossed behind my back. And at the time, as I was talking with these business leaders, they were bewildered. You know, they didn't understand our system. They didn't understand what was going on. And so they were willing to accept my and others' reassurance that, oh, it would be fine. Fast forward. I'm out of office. It's the fall of 2013, last fall. And not only are some of these same voices saying, oh, we're, you know, not going to, you know, raise the debt limit. Remember, this is not for future spending. This is for spending the Congress has already approved of. That's the way it works. Oh, we're not going to pay. And not only that, we're going to shut the government down. So I say to, you know, my friends in the State Department and other places, I said, could I take a look at what is being said around the world, not just in the English press, but, you know, other languages. And what had been bewilderment 2 years before was now contempt. And that was manifest when the President of the United States had to cancel an important trip to Asia to attend something called the East Asia Summit, which I had pushed to get us into so that we could be at the same table on a lot of these economic and strategic issues. And because the government was shut down, the President could not go to the summit in Asia. The President of China was there, Xi Jinping. Vladimir Putin was there, and they could not be happier. The reports I got was how they were just basically going around saying, you know, look, America can't govern itself. Its political system doesn't work anymore. We have a system where we can get things done. Look to us. And there was even a statement by a high-ranking Chinese official, which was forwarded to me, saying it was time to de-Americanize the world. It was time to look for another currency to be the reserve currency that the dollar has been in the world. Now, thankfully, that disaster was also averted, but I was able to see our country from a very interesting and important vantage point. I sometimes felt like people around the world followed what happened in Washington more than some of us do, because they followed it almost day by day, minute by minute, especially if they thought it was going to affect anything that was of interest to them, and the global economy is. So in my chapter, I felt like I was, you know, kind of in an alternative universe. I'm out there saying, invest in America. You know, we have the most productive workers, which we do. We have the soundest financial system, rule of law, independent judiciary. Money still floods in to buy our government bonds. You know, America is the place you should be. And there was some evidence that countries were beginning to move manufacturing back and all the rest. At the same time, people are looking at our political system and scratching their heads or even saying, you know, time to move on. And part of what I want people who read the book to think about is how we maintain our leadership at home and abroad. It is so important that the United States continue to make hard choices in our own economy, make it work for everybody, you know, be able to look at evidence and have a reasoned debate, to set an example for ourselves and for others in these new democracies, because it's important to us. It's important, as Vivian said, I'm going to be a grandmother, so I'm feeling even more of a commitment to the future. But it's also important because America matters to the world. And the world, in our increasingly interdependent world, the world matters to America. So I hope that as people read the book, you'll be thinking about the role not just leaders play, because that is not the way we've ever maintained our greatness as a country. I mean, what is so unique about us is the role that citizens play, that small and medium-sized businesses play, that localities play, and this great big quilt of America works because people are all making their contributions. And we can have vigorous political debates. That's part of our DNA. Sometimes one party's up, another time another party's up. We do that. But what we can't afford to do is to undermine the democratic process by arguing that compromise is a dirty word and that some people in public life... You've heard it, I've heard it. They proudly say they will never compromise on anything, as though they had all the truth. I mean, a direct channel to the divine. And that is not who we are. I have been in countries where dictators, autocrats, people, theocrats, who claim that they and only they have the truth. We've never been that. Thank goodness we've never been that. And we should never allow anyone who runs for office to proudly claim he or she will never compromise, because that undermines the democratic process. Nice.
Very good. Yeah. You write at the end, and I have to tell you all, I've read the book twice and I cried. Both, I cried at the end. No one had a bigger influence on my life or did more to shape the person I became than my mother. What would Dorothy Rodham be saying to you and Chelsea and the rest of us this evening if she were still with us?
Well, I lost my mother while I was Secretary of State, and she had lived with us in Washington for about 10 years. And it was such a joy for me to be able to come home from the State Department, come home from a long trip, and have my mother there. And my daughter and she had such a close relationship. They talked every day, and you know, Chelsea would come to visit her as often as she could, and her other grandchildren were in the Washington area. So it was just such a rich time in both of our lives. And thankfully, she was healthy until the very, very end. And she would probably, she gave me lots of advice. Let me put it that way. She she would probably be critiquing the book. She was a great reader. And she would be saying, well, I'm not sure you explained that well enough, or could you have used another example? I mean, she would have given me really good, constructive criticism and feedback. She would also be very grateful that I had this opportunity to serve. She used to watch the news, and she would be very worried about everything going on when I traveled. And so she'd be happy that I'm not traveling as much. That was one of her big concerns. But my mother had such a difficult childhood, which I write about in the book, because I was amazed when I became a teenager and started understanding what my mother had gone through, how neglected and abused and abandoned she was by her then teenage parents who were totally unready for responsibility for either her or her younger sister. How when they divorced, when my mother was 7 or 8 and her sister was 2 years younger, neither of them wanted the girls, and the only place that would take them in back in the 1920s, extra mouths to feed, were the paternal grandparents in California. So they were living in Chicago, and my grandparents, I never knew my grandfather, I did know my grandmother, they put these two little girls by themselves on the train in Chicago and sent them to Los Angeles. I learned about that, and I had a hard time really grasping it, because I had such a wonderful, stable family. You know, my father was a small businessman, he worked really hard. My mother was a homemaker who was constantly reading and taking college courses and so supportive of our family. I could not really grasp how any parents could do that. And it sparked an interest
in me in trying to see what I could do to help children. I worked hard at college and law school on issues of abuse and neglect and adoption and foster care and carried that forward. So my mother was a constant inspiration. She was a big part of my commitment to service. My father was a rock-ribbed, up-by-your-bootstraps, independent, work ethic, conservative Republican. And the gender gap started in my house in Park Ridge, Illinois, because my mother canceled out his vote practically every single election. But we had a lot of vigorous debates around our kitchen table. We just had a terrifically rich, loving, high standard setting upbringing, and she was at the center of all of that. She had so many young friends. She became friends with a lot of Chelsea's friends, and young people were always at our house in Washington. They would, you know, they would bring her ice cream. They would come by to watch The Sopranos or Boardwalk Empire with her, or tuning in to Dancing with the Stars. I mean, she had her regular programs, and people knew, and they'd come and be part of that. So I think she would be grateful that I've had this chance, but she would be very quick to say, don't let any of this go to your head. You know, you have to be rooted in your values, your faith, who you are. She told me when I was a little girl that, you know, I was responsible for my actions and I would have to take responsibility for being the, you know, as she would say, making the choice, the hard choice, would I be the lead actor in my own life or a bit player in somebody else's? She was always filled with hard-won lessons from her own upbringing. And I think she'd like the book. She'd particularly like the picture in there of Chelsea's wedding. It's never been published before. It's a picture of my husband and me with Chelsea and her wonderful husband, Mark, with my mother in the middle. It was one of the happiest days of her life. So I think she'd really like that.
This really spoke to me when you ask her, how did she make it through all the times?
Right.
And she said, at certain points in my life, people showed me kindness.
Right.
So what I want to say to you tonight is, thank you for coming and sharing time with us this evening.
Thank you, Vivian. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you all so much. Thank you.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen. Dorothy's daughter and Chelsea's mother.
Thank you
Chelsea's
so much.
Mother.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you all. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you all.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, how are you? Oh, thank you. Hello, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Hi. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you. Bless you. Thank you.